This is Melissa, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. And this is Arizona History. Today's reading is from the book titled Tucson Memories, written by Bonnie Henry and published in 1992. The chapter is entitled Tell Me You Remember, Article Number 7, Old Pueblo Transit. Rodeo fans, DeVins plant workers, nurses working the graveyard shift, little old ladies on their way to church, kids on their way to the matinee shooting up. All at one time or another plunked their nickels down, settled into the green upholstery, and let the old Pueblo Transit Company deliver them to their assorted destinations. It began with one truck turned bus, one man, one need. In 1924, the year the late Roy Law Sr. began what he originally called the Occidental Bus Lines, neither the still-operating trolley nor Tucson Rapid Transit buses served much of this town's south side. The first route went south on Meyer to 17th Street, then back again. Meyer Street was bustling back then, says Roy Louse Jr., son of the man whose buses would run for more than a half a century in this town. The family's Tucson's roots run deep. In 1882, Roy Sr.'s father, Fernando, first rode into Arizona atop a wagon filled with watermelons. His father was in the produce business in Mexico, says Roy Jr. He sold the melons, sent the money in the wagon back, and said, "This is it." After kicking around the mining towns of Fairbank and Tombstone, Fernando wound up in Tucson in 1888, where he soon became the proprietor of a four-chair barber shop on West Congress Street. Later came a cigar store and pool hall. It had a gambling in the basement, too. Poker games. By the time Fernando's son, Roy Sr., was a teenager, the place was also sporting a boxing ring out back. "Dad was a pretty good boxer," says Roy Jr. "He used to teach the other kids." After a stint with the Coast Guard artillery team during World War I, the young boxer came back to Tucson and a succession of bookkeeping jobs. "Even though he didn't finish high school, he had a good head for figures," says Roy Jr. His first bus was a used 23 Chevrolet truck. It had a rear entrance and two rows of wooden seats facing each other. Windows were open holes in the frame, protected from the elements with homemade canvas roll-ups. Not all of the customers could afford the nickel fare. They'd barter with Dad. They'd give him tamales, rice, wood, chickens. Nonetheless, the first day's route managed to take in the princely sum of $12. Dad couldn't get over it. Roy Sr., along with brothers Walter and Charlie, kept the bus in a state of chug down at the family garage on Meyer Street. "Dad would drive the bus all day, fix the bus all night," says Roy Jr. Other bus routes were soon added to the line. St. Mary's Hospital, Ory Park, the Arizona School for the Deaf and the Blind. "Dad would get a hold of whatever buses he could," says Roy Jr. "There weren't two buses that look alike." The lines kept snaking farther and farther away from the downtown barrios, sometimes straight into the competition. Dad spent all his time in court. "We had a trail of buses going up and down that street," against the competition of Tucson Rapid Transit. Night and day, defense workers at the sprawling consolidated Volte plant south of town crammed into Occidental buses during the World War II years. "We packed them in," says Roy Jr. Still, the pre-war fares remained nickel ahead. Dad never raised the fare till after the war. Rodeo was also good for the bus business. During the 1946 season, Occidental hauled 6,000 fans, roughly 10% of Tucson's population, to and from the parade and rodeo in one day. By then, the company was operating out of a brand new bus depot at Broadway and Church. "Dad paid $15,000 for the property," says Roy Jr., who came back from the war and went to work for his father's company. "There was a service station there. We tore that down, built a waiting room and lunch counter. 19 and a half hours the buses ran, 5:30 a.m. to 1 a.m. In the summertime, those buses would come into the station steaming, says Roy Jr. Sometimes they never made it back at all. Yes, buses would break down. In 1949, Roy Sr. was seeking a financial partner. He needed a new fleet of buses, says Roy Jr. He didn't have the money. A family meeting was called among the brothers, and he asked them if they wanted to buy it out, says Roy. They hemmed and hawed. He couldn't make the sale. So Roy Jr. turned to an old colleague, Emory C. Johnson. A partnership was formed. It made a difference, says Roy Jr. Along with the partnership came a new name, Old Pueblo Transit Company. New name, new colors. Off went the old yellow and black color scheme. On went the new colors, green and white. New routes, the airport, Benson Highway, even old Tucson. South 6 was still the best route. St. Mary's the second best, says Roy Jr. Most of the drivers in the driver's seats were minorities. Dad hired the first black driver in the city, says Roy Jr. In the beginning, his drivers didn't even have fare boxes. He never knew how much they were taking in. He just trusted them. He'd give them advances, pick them up if their cars broke down, take their kids to the hospital. Still, Old Pueblo was beset with several bitter labor disputes, including a 1950 strike that saw passengers peppered with buckshot and strikers forming an impenetrable wall around the buses trying to leave the company yard, by then located on West Irvington Road. I was driving one of those buses and that tried to nudge through the strikers, says Roy Jr. Again, the company wound up in court, this time winning an injunction against the strikers. By 1968, a faltering Tucson Rapid Transit was up for sale. Buy it, many of Tucson's movers and shakers told Old Pueblo's owners. Dad said he would do it, but at his own pace. Some of the routes weren't very good. Instead, the city bought the ailing company, renaming it SunTran. 6 years later, the city tried to swallow up the competition as well. They threatened to condemn us. The matter went to the polls, where voters resoundedly took Old Pueblo's side. We were elated, says Roy Jr. 2 months after savoring the victory, Roy Sr. died at age 76. In 1978, Tucson government came calling again, this time threatening an audit of Old Pueblo, which by then was leasing its 21 buses directly from the city. Rather than submit to the audit, Old Pueblo allowed a city takeover. The city was determined to be in the bus business, says Johnson, by then Old Pueblo's controlling partner. It was just time. I had high aspirations to keep it, says Roy Jr. Mr. Johnson offered it to me. I tried to muster up the money. In retrospect, it's lucky I didn't. As for the company that began with one route, one truck, and fares that sometimes wore feathers, Roy Jr. says, it was a dinosaur, but a paying dinosaur. This is Melissa, volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. Article number 8, THS All-Girl Band. When the boys in the band wouldn't let them in, they started one of their own, and it's been one long toot ever since. File this one under chauvinistic oinkers. In the fall of 38, there was no such thing as girls playing in the Tucson High School band. Orchestra, yes. Band, no. If a girl wanted to play in the band, she was out of luck. First-year student Rosemary Burse, Koschmider, found that out after THS music director W.A. Sewell turned her and her saxophone down. Next stop, for Koschmider, the office of Principal C.A. Carson. I told him I didn't think it was fair. He said maybe we could have a girls' band the following year. And we did. That victory was just another in a long string of struggles for Koschmider, who would go on to become president of the Tucson Musicians Association. My music career began at 11, she says. I took the violin. My dad thought that was the only instrument to play. I wanted to play the saxophone, but he said that wasn't for me. Undeterred, Karschmeyer spied an ad one day in the paper. Saxophone for sale, $25. I got on my bicycle and rode from where we used to live near the Broadway underpass out to First Avenue and Roger Road. I bought the saxophone, hung it on my handlebars, and rode home. My father didn't like it one bit. But by then, Karschmeyer was well into blowing her own horn. I was renting a clarinet for $1.50 a year and taking lessons at school. That got me out of cooking and sewing lessons, which I wasn't too crazy about anyway. At the same time Karschmeyer was learning how to play the saxophone, another young girl in town, Lois Broom Burke, was also becoming enamored of that instrument. I wanted to play the saxophone in elementary school at Sam Hughes, remembers Burke. The principal said, "Why would you want to do that?" But when I got to junior high at Mansfield, they let me play. They had what they called a vocations class, one for boys, one for girls, where they talk about various careers, says Burke. The band practiced during the girls' vocation class. So I took vocations with the boys so I could play in the band. But when Burke was promoted to high school during midterm of the 39-40 school year, she found the same welcome Karschmeyer had experienced. They made me sign up for orchestra. Well, there were no saxophones in the orchestra. There I was sitting when Professor Sewell pointed his finger at me and said, "Girl, what are you doing there?" He talked me into playing the flute, which I never liked. It didn't take long for Burke to discover the girls' band at THS. The first year, there were 26 members. The uniform was white skirts and red satin blouses. They marched in the rodeo parade and the Armistice Day parade. They also played at basketball games, but football games were strictly for the boys' marching band. The solution? Their own dance band, made up of more experienced band members, boys and girls. I'd wanted to play in the school dance band in the worst way, recalls Karschmeyer, but the only way a girl could play was if one of the boys got sick. And so, while the regular THS swing band played to swaying couples in the school cafeteria, Karschmeyer, Burke, and company played at the VFW hall, or the women's club, or at the swimming pools. And then one day I got a call from the Blue Moon, and the owner was desperate. She needed a band that night. My dad said, "You're not going to play in a nightclub." But we did. That was our first paid gig. After graduation, Karschmeyer married and moved out of town. Burke enrolled at the University of Arizona. In the summer of 43, I was jerking sodas at Martin Drugstore in the Geronimo Hotel when Humpy Hampton walked in, recalls Burke. He was one time the leader of the Blue Moon Orchestra, had sold Burke her first saxophone and given her some early lessons while he was still a college student. He told me Wayne Webb needed a sax player. "The Blue Moon put me through college," says Burke. In the meantime, Karschmeyer had returned to Tucson and landed a job at the Blue Moon playing her sax right next to Burke. Once again, Karschmeyer found herself starting up her own band, which Burke quickly joined, an all-girl band that played everywhere from Eloy to Ajo to Safford. After they kept losing out auditions for local gigs, Karschmeyer was told it was because folks wanted an accordion in the band. So she bought an accordion and taught herself to play. Today, it's her main mode of music. Following a tour in Japan, Karschmeyer put in 9 years down at Manny's on North Stone Avenue. After Manning, she went on tour in the Far East and then played 9 years in clubs all over Alaska. Meanwhile, Burke had married and moved to California. She also returned to the local music scene in 1959. Her resume includes a clarinetist with the Tucson Symphony and co-founder of an 8-piece orchestra known as the Farrer Sax. As for the girls in the band at the high school level, Tucson High invited them to join the swing band starting with the 43-44 school year, says former swing band leader and THS teacher John Beringer. But more than a decade would pass before girls were allowed to play with the school's marching band. Article Number 9. They sleep around us. Their bones molder beneath our townhouses and parking garages, our office buildings and garbage dumps. Progress, their only tombstone. The dead of Tucson are as scattered as the places they once called home. Burials were pretty casual. There was not a great deal of control over who was buried where, says George W. Wallace, Jr., an amateur historian who has surveyed many of the old graveyards that pock both Tucson and the desert around it. One of Tucson's earliest cemeteries, near Mission Road and West Congress Street, transcended its chasms of both time and culture. In 1949, a bulldozer tearing through human graves in the long-abandoned cemetery unearthed two different burial sites, one Christian, one skipping back to a pre-pottery culture. Not that any of this was news to the Tucsonians, who for years had plundered the old graveyard for artifacts, or to the city itself, which had long stashed its trash and garbage around the gravesites. Once the Presidio became fact after 1782, a military cemetery was established within its walls, near what is now the corner of Church and Alameda Streets. Bones were found during construction of the old Pima County Courthouse in 1929, and again in 1970 when new water lines were installed along West Alameda Street. It was the dead of this town who started Tucson's inexplorable march eastward, a march that went straight up what was fittingly called Cemetery Street, now known as Alameda, all the way to Stone Avenue. Perhaps some of the first occupants of that cemetery, which splayed north and east of the corner of Stone Avenue and Alameda, were Union soldiers who succumbed in Tucson to their wounds from the 1862 skirmish at Picacho Peak. Soon to follow were the dead from Camp Lowell, established in the mid-1860s on land southeast of what is now Broadway and 6th Avenue. In 1875, 2 years after the entire camp packed up and moved to Fort Lowell, the old National Cemetery, as it was then called, was closed to future burials. After Fort Lowell was abandoned in 1892, 80 of its 91 graves were disinterred and the remains sent to the San Francisco National Cemetery for reburial. In 1880, 5 years after the old National Cemetery shut down, the railroad came to town, rumbling right through the northeast corner of the graveyard. Commerce, including the old Star and Citizen Building, gradually blanketed the rest of the dusty gravesites. City fathers, however, lost no time in coming up with another burial ground. On June 1, 1875, 1 day after the National Cemetery closed its last grave, a burial occurred at the town's newest graveyard. Bounded by Speedway on the north, Main Street on the west, Stone Avenue on the east, and 2nd Street on the south, the Court Street Cemetery, as it came to be called, was divided neatly in two, Catholics to the east, Protestants to the west. In July 1907, Herbert B. Tenney, J. Knox Corbett, John Ormsby, and Frank L. Cullen, all officers of the newly formed Tucson Cemetery Association, announced the purchase of 240 acres of farmland north of the city on Oracle Road. It would become Evergreen Cemetery. Not only would this new cemetery offer a permanent record of each lot, but the 80 acres fronting Oracle Road would boast something called perpetual care, with a lawn maintained equal to any private lawn in the city. On January 1, 1908, the City Council passed an ordinance prohibiting burials in the Court Street Cemetery. Everyone there had to be moved. Getting the dead ones out turned out to be more of a chore than the City Council ever envisioned. Not until March 1916, says Wallace, could the Council call the old Court Street Cemetery abandoned and advertise for bids on the property. Just days later, 88 lots sold for a total of $10,000. Many of the dead moved from the old Court Cemetery to the new cemeteries north of town that were exhumed by local undertaker John Riley. Other once-ruled graveyards is the old Pest House Cemetery on West Speedway near Silverbell Road. Into its burial ground went indigent victims of contagious diseases. As for the still living, they were banished to a nearby building known as the Pest House. In June 1966, bodies from the seven visible graves were moved to Holy Hope Cemetery to allow for the realignment of West Speedway. Spirits, however, may still be lingering in the area. Staff and longtime residents of the former Arizona Elks Long-Term Care Unit, which is built near the old Pest House, used to report all sorts of eerie doings. The unit's director of nursing said, "We've all experienced doors opening and slamming shut, and howling screams going down the hall." Article number 10. Meet you under the clock. "Excuse me," says the woman in a hurry. "That clock obviously is wrong. Do you have the right time?" So I give her the time. My memories I keep to myself. About this clock standing on the sidewalk in front of us, and what it meant to all of us, whoever did business along Congress Street 20, 30, 40 years ago. I don't tell her about Elmer Present and how he came to town in 1926 and started up a jewelry store down on East Congress Street. And I don't tell her how everyone from movie stars to bankers once kept time to the tick-tock of the clock he set up a few years later out on the sidewalk in front of his store. Early 1943, Manny Mendez, 17, is starting off the day in a brand new job as an apprentice watchmaker at Daniel's Jewelry Company, 9 East Congress Street. One of his chores, he soon learns, will be to wind the large antique clock that looms outside 16 feet above the sidewalk. "Every Monday morning for 27 years I wound that clock," says Mendez, now a watchmaker and jeweler in business for himself. "My father purchased it from a Maryland jeweler's. He had it shipped out on the train. With the name of the store painted on both sides of its face, one button clock becomes an instant advertisement. It also becomes, at times, a convenient perch. I used to climb up on top of it to watch the rodeo parades," Paul Present, Elmer's son, remembers. Years tick away. The war ends. Tucson begins to bustle in earnest. We all throng down to Congress Street, to its shops, theaters, restaurants. "Meet you under the clock" becomes the watchword. Around 48 or so, Mendez and watchmaker Manx Crump completely rebuild the clock. New bearings, shaft, everything. "It wasn't a new clock even when I started work," says Mendez. "It was an antique." The 40s melt into the 50s. Still, the crowds keep coming to Congress Street, and the clock keeps time to it all. In 1954, Daniel switches places with Lerner's Shops, moving to 21 East Congress. The clock, of course, also makes the move. Hollywood comes to town in 1956 and heads straight for the clock. The name of the movie? A Kiss Before Dying, starring Robert Wagner and Joanne Woodward. The 60s push the way onto the street. In 1962, Elmer Present sells his store, and several other he owns throughout the state, to the Gordon Jewelry Corporation of Houston. But the name Daniel stays on the shop. So does the clock out front. Why, it's a landmark. Just like the neon oxen on top of Steinfeld's. Who could think of tearing it down? The city council decides they want to buy the clock in 1987 because of a massive redo of East Congress Street, new sidewalks, lighting, landscaping. Before that occurs, Terry Bainbridge, engineer for the project, happens upon the clock. "I saw that Daniels was going out of business. I walked in and said, 'Hey, what are you guys going to do with that clock?' They said, 'You want it?' So I talked with Mr. Gordon of Gordon Jewelry. They donated it. A deal is struck. The city agrees to shell out $18,000 to have the clock refurbished and installed elsewhere. The name Daniels will stay on the clock face. A plaque attested to the generosity of Gordon's will go on the base of the clock. George Helwig of Ye Olde Clock Shop gets the repair job. He replaces the wind-up mechanism with an electric motor, completely disassembles the clock, sandblasts, paints, resembles it. In 1988, the clock in all of its former glory went back up, just a couple of blocks from the old neighborhood, on a strip of sidewalk along Church Avenue between Congress and Broadway. It belongs now to a quieter part of town, on the edge of a small park where a statue of Pancho Villa rears up over both the grass and the occasional transient. Unlike Mr. Villa, however, the clock is no longer stuck in time. As of the summer of 92, it was keeping perfect time. This is Melissa, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then, under Programming Links, left-click On Demand Podcasts. Or you can now listen to Sun Sounds on your smart home device. Or you can take Sun Sounds with you. You can get our stream and on demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for both Android and Apple phones.